ready to hear argument from Petitioner and Director of the State Employees Workers' Compensation Division versus Evans.
May it please the Court, Ms. Barbara Stroud will present argument for Petitioner. She was there 4 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, my name is Barbara Stroud. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I'm here representing the Petitioner. This is a case in which a state agency was denied its stay in court because of a mistake by an Assistant Attorney General. However, it's a case where there are two separate and independent reasons why this default judgment should be set aside and the state agency should have its stay in court. The first is a statute, Section 39.001 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which provides that a default judgment may not be taken against the state unless 10 days' notice is given to the Attorney General's office. And that statute has been ignored by the lower courts in this case. And the second is the three-part Craddock test that applies to all litigants. And if that test is met, then a default judgment must be set aside. I will address point of error number one first, that the Court of Appeals erred in ignoring Section 39.001 and holding that it was moot based on its ruling on Craddock. And then I will address the second point of error, that the Court of Appeals erred in holding that the state did not support its motion for new trial with evidence. Section 39.001 provides that notice of intent to take a default judgment against the state agency must be mailed to the Attorney General no later than 10 days before the entry of the default. And 39.002 provides that if that statute is not complied with, then the default judgment shall be set aside without cause.
Now, the posture of this case is the state answered the lawsuit.
Yes, the state did answer the lawsuit.
They just didn't appear at trial.
That's correct.
Why do you consider that to be the default judgment then that got entered? What benefit did the plaintiff obtain in terms of what it had to do at the trial of the case that it didn't otherwise, I mean, that it gained because of this, of some sort of notion of default? What procedure benefited the plaintiff by the defendant not being there?
Well, as this court explained in Stoner v. Thompson in 1979, where the defendant fails to appear at trial, the plaintiff must still put on evidence before it can take a judgment, but it is still a default judgment situation. The benefit that the plaintiff received is that the state, the defendant, did not have its day in court, did not have the opportunity to present its defenses, and did not have an opportunity to have the facts of the case heard by a jury. And that benefit would not be outweighed by granting a motion for new trial and allowing her day, or reimbursing her for her costs and allowing her day in court, but also allowing the state of state in court to present its defenses. And that...
How would you implement this if the plaintiff doesn't know the state's not going to show up until the day of trial? How could the plaintiff then give a 10-day notice before the trial?
Well, we believe that in this situation where it's a default judgment for a failure to appear at trial, that on that day, a default judgment cannot be taken on that day. But at that point,
you could try the lawsuit, put in all the evidence, and just withhold entering the judgment for 10 days.
That's correct. I believe that the court or the plaintiff would have to give notice to the Attorney General's office, 10-day notice, that they intended to take a default judgment if an appearance was not made and allow 10 days to cure and make an appearance.
The state had notice of this jury trial, didn't it?
That's correct.
Had it for how much, far longer than 10 days?
That's correct.
When you get a notice of the jury trial against the, that's been requested against the state, isn't it implicit that the whole purpose of the jury trial is to get a judgment?
That is implicit, but we believe that this statute on its face makes it clear that before you can actually take a default judgment against the state, you must give 10 days notice, and that's designed to give the state its day in court. It's much like with a default for failure to file an answer. When you receive the petition, you have notice that if you do not answer, a default judgment will be taken.
And you don't think that a notice to come to a jury trial is a notice that if you don't show up, you lose?
I think the message is implicit in a notice of a jury trial, that of course is the purpose of the jury trial. But again, we've got the special statute that was passed by the legislature that makes it very clear that before a default judgment can be entered, Notice must be given to the Attorney General's office.
Well, it could have been made clear, and they could have used the technical term nil dicit, which applies to just this type of situation. The legislature could have used that term, and they did not, and we're really left to try to ascertain what the legislature had in mind when it used the term default judgment, which has both a narrow meaning and a broader, but somewhat less frequently used.
We, of course, contend that the broad meaning is what the legislature meant because of the policy reasons behind this statute, the policy reasons being that before a judgment can be taken against the state should have its day in court. We must presume when the statute was originally passed in 1983, and at that time, this court had already spoken in Stoner v. Thompson in 1979, where it discussed the specific types of default judgments and said there are several kinds of default judgments. One where you fail to answer, one a nihil dicit situation where you've imposed an answer but it doesn't place the merits at issue, and then third, a default judgment for failure to appear at trial. That there are those three kinds of default judgments. And this court had also already spoken in its Craddock line of cases where it had said Craddock applies to both default judgments for failure to answer and for failure to appear at trial. So I believe this court had made it clear that there are several kinds of default judgments, and the legislature chose not to restrict this statute just to default judgments for failure to answer.
When the plaintiff serves their notice of setting, or can they just tag on to the notice, this is also will serve as notice under the applicable statute. If the state doesn't show up, we're going to ask for default?
I don't believe that that would be adequate under the statute, because the statute specifically says that before a default judgment can be taken, a specific notice of intent to take a default judgment must be mailed to the Attorney General's office.
And you can't say that if you don't show up at trial, I'm going to ask the judge for default. That wouldn't suffice.
We don't believe that it would suffice under the statute. In this case, that issue is not presented, because in this case, that kind of notice was not given, and it's absolutely clear in this case that the statute was not complied with in any way. And the statute does clearly speak to that issue, that if it's not met, the default judgment must be set aside without cause.
To further engage in hypotheticals, trial judge, if we read the statute the way you do, would the trial judge still have the power to impose sanctions on the state for the additional cost, burden, and delay that a second hearing might impose?
Certainly. I think the trial court has many of the remedies that would put the plaintiff in a better situation. Could impose sanctions on the Attorney General's office, could perhaps hold the Attorney General's office in contempt of court after analyzing the reasons why the Attorney General did not appear at trial. There are certainly other remedies that could be used to remedy the harm to the plaintiff.
Tell us about your Craddock argument.
We believe that the court has erred in imposing a hyper-technical requirement that the exhibits to the motion for a new trial be removed from the motion, remarked as exhibits, and offered into evidence at the hearing. We don't believe that that's the law of this state, that procedure be followed. But even if it is, in this case, any specific objections were waived. First of all, this court explained in Ward v. Nava in 1972 that if there is no record of the evidentiary hearing on Craddock, that the only evidence to be considered by the court on appeal is, quote, the affidavit attached to the motion, end quote. So that certainly indicates that attaching the affidavit to the motion is adequate. This court has also referred on several occasions in its opinions to, quote, the motion for a new trial and the accompanying affidavit. This court made that reference in Holt-Atherton Industries v. Pine in 1992 and Cliff v. Huggins in 1987. And this court has also refused writ based on no reversible error in a case styled Southland Paint Company v. Thousand Oaks Racquet Club in 1986, in which the first element of Craddock was established only by the affidavit in support of the motion for a new trial. Then a hearing was held, and the movement at the hearing did not present any live evidence. He chose simply to rely on his affidavit, and the respondent did present evidence at the hearing in that case. And the court held that the first element of Craddock was satisfied just by the affidavit attached to the motion for a new trial. And this court denied writ based on no reversible error. So the opinions of this court have certainly indicated that it is sufficient just to attach the affidavits and other exhibits to the motion for a new trial, and that there is not a requirement to remove them and, again, offer them into evidence at the hearing.
If that is, assuming that's correct on the proof, would you then touch on whether or not there was evidence from the respondent was sufficient as to the knowledge of some people in the Attorney General's office, not the actual attorney, to raise a question about conscious indifference for the Office of Attorney General as a whole?
I don't believe that in this case the evidence presented by the respondent was adequate to negate the first element of Craddock. There were no controverting affidavits and there was no controverting testimony about the knowledge of the Assistant Attorney General. In fact, their evidence showed, just supported the first element of Craddock in that after the case was set for trial on April 22, 1991, there were no further discussions about the case, and there was nothing to show that anyone in the Attorney General's office actually did know about the trial setting. What the argument that the respondent made at the hearing was that we didn't negate the knowledge of the client, the state agency, the State Employees Workers' Compensation Division, and that the first element was not met because the knowledge of the client wasn't negated. We do not believe that it is a requirement that the knowledge of the client be negated to satisfy the first element of Craddock.
I believe your time is up. You completed your thought.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please the court? Mr. Tom Ryan will present argument for respondent.
Please, court, the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed quite simply because the statute that the Attorney General relies on doesn't apply to this fact situation. The Attorney General selected its day in court, April 22, 1991. The Attorney General served notices on the plaintiff, Paulette Evans. And based on that notice, which incorporates the representation in Rule 245, that Attorney General makes a good faith representation to be ready to try the case on that date, we likewise were there with our witnesses, our depositions, our court's charge, motion in limine, and everything else. We were ready to go to trial. And it was not until the Attorney General didn't show up, and this wasn't instantaneous things, it pleased the court. Judge Bernays is a very cautious trial judge, and he called the case about 9 o'clock in the morning and waited around until about 10 or 10:30 for the Attorney General to show up or some word from him. And that was when the evidence was put on the judge's presenter.
Did you call the AG's office and ask them where they were?
Beg your pardon?
Did you call the AG's office and ask them where they were?
No, I did not.
Did the clerk call them, or did anybody call to find out what happened?
I can't speak for what the clerk did or did not do, Your Honor. I know I did not call. I mean, I sat in the courtroom waiting until the judge tell me what I should do. The statute plainly says that the AG is to be notified if there is an intent to take a default judgment. Doesn't say who should make the notification. Doesn't place the burden on the plaintiff to make that notification. It's silent as to who makes that notification. But by using the word intent, I assume it means the plaintiff's attorney, because I don't think the judge would intend to take a default judgment. But I went to Groesbeck, Texas on that date, not intending to take a default judgment, but intending to try the case on the merits, and that's exactly what I did.
Mr. Reitman, apparently after you waited around for a while, you formed an intent at that time to take a default judgment.
I beg to differ with you, Your Honor, because there is a distinction between what took place on that date and the true default judgment. And no answer default. In that in a no-answer default judgment, all of the plaintiff's pleadings are taken to be true. And the judgment is entered there except in cases of unliquidated damages had to be proved of that. In this instance, the Attorney General had appeared, answered, and conducted extensive discovery, and they were entitled to have the case proved according to the evidence. That's exactly what we did, including their evidence of their alleged sole cause defense was presented to the trial judge at the hearing on the judgment.
Mr. Riley, you're an experienced trial lawyer. You've been around many years. You know that trial without when the opposition is not there is a lot easier than the trial.
Absolutely.
The opposition is there with the, to present their side of the case. But the statute does speak about notice of intent to take a default judgment. And at least by 10:30 or at some point after you arrive ready to try the case, you form an intent to take a default judgment. And the statute is very clear that when you form that intent, might be bad policy, might be bad legislation, but the legislature says that the state is entitled to 10 days notice. Well, why does the statute not apply?
Because, Your Honor, that statute must of necessity apply to those instances where there's no answer to been filed.
And it didn't say that.
Well, I know it doesn't say it, but it should have.
Oh, you're asking us to read that in the terms of the statute?
Well, I think that, yes, Your Honor, it has to be considered in connection with the other rules that were applicable on the date on that occurrence there. In other words, if I had told the trial judge over there that, look, opposition is not here, I'm not going to go to trial, he could have dismissed that case for water prosecution right on the spot.
Mr. Ragland, after you finished putting on your case, if the Attorney General had come running in the back door of the courtroom, they could have started calling their witnesses, could they not?
Yes, sir.
If the court had, after you completed putting on your case, if the court had called recess to come back at a certain time, you could have come back. You would have come back in an ordinary way.
That's correct.
If the court had called a recess for 10 days, while he made notification as specified in the statute, your cause would have still been pending, wouldn't it? Your case would have still been pending.
That's correct.
So a case can be interrupted for 10 days without any real prejudice to the petitioner.
I would agree with the first part of that statement, Your Honor. The second one, I'm not agreeing with about
the
prejudice part of it.
If a case is postponed or recessed, then the parties who are present can go ahead and present whatever else they need to in the case when the case is reconvened, can they not?
Theoretically, that's true, Your Honor.
I just wonder if the legislature contemplated that a court would recess a cause where a default judgment might appear to be imminent for a 10-day period.
Your Honor, that takes a mighty powerful interpretation of that statute to read that into it, my judgment. In light of all of the rules that this court has handed down about expediting the trial of cases and disposition of the cases, and specific rules 245 and 247, that the case can't be removed from the docket, it's got to be tried when it's tried unless there's an agreement or good cause or something like that, it doesn't seem to me that the legislature would have passing statutes which contemplated the Attorney General being able to disrupt the trial docket for 10 days at a time. I just can't believe that that's what the legislature
intended. But until the Attorney General was not there when you completed putting on your case, there was no way for you to know that there was going to be a default situation, was it? Because you didn't know what the Attorney General would show up.
I expected him to show up, yes.
So you didn't know, and there was no way for the court to know that the Attorney General wasn't going to show up in time to present his case. The only time the court knew it was when you completed putting on your case, and then there was no one there to respond. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
So if the court is going to contemplate a default judgment, that's when he begins contemplating it, not when you start putting your case on. Wouldn't that be the correct way to analyze that?
I suppose so, Judge. If you took that approach to it, that the courts contemplate that I've just heard evidence in support of a default judgment, sort of after the fact. I quite frankly don't know many trial judges that would.
The court would say he's heard evidence in support of a judgment, and then if there's no controverting evidence put on, then a judgment.
That's what happened in this case. The judgment was entered later in the day.
Mr. Ragland, was there an IAB award in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that in your client's favor?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so the state appealed?
No, it was a favorable award, but it was less than the...
Not as favorable as you would have liked.
That's correct,
so your client.
And it would have been appealed anyway, so it's just kind of a routine situation.
So under the facts of this case, because of the nature of workers' compensation, you could not have just... asked for a dismissal.
I could not have taken a suit, Your Honor, and if the court had dismissed it for want of prosecution, I would have been in a terrible mess because
you had a counterclaim.
The court would not have would have lost jurisdiction of it unless I could have rushed somewhere and got it reinstated, which would have been additional.
But if this had been an award that the state had appealed from, the IAB award, and you had well, I guess under any circumstances, you would have had to file pleadings asking for affirmative relief.
That's right. I would have, Your Honor. I would have been in the same situation on a non-suit or a dismissal for one prosecution. My client's claim would have been destroyed.
Let me shift gears with you down two issues down to and assume that the Craddock test applies. And assume that the state was within its power and at the time of the motion of the trial to rely on its affidavits attached to their motion only. Do you agree or disagree with opposing counsel that the evidence that you showed to controvert was not that anyone in the Attorney General's office was consciously indifferent to the April 22nd trial setting, but that there were people at the state client, at the Workers' Compensation Board, who knew of this trial setting?
Well, Your Honor, you know, and this court has recognized in the context of summary judgment affidavits and controverting affidavits that it's virtually impossible for someone to controvert a negative, prove a negative. In other words, by way of affidavits, me to prove what went on in the minds of the Attorney General's office, it's virtually impossible to do that. What we did show was that there were, I believe, five or six or seven people in the Attorney General's office who were regularly notified about settings and depositions and that sort of thing. And the Attorney General made no effort to establish by their affidavits even account for their knowledge or in lack of action.
When you say five or six or seven, you mean the whole list starting with Morales?
No, Your Honor. It's in the statement of facts. I dig it out for you if you like, but it was taken from copies of correspondence that the attorney representing the director of compensation sent copies of conversations, communications to their staff people. And it's listed plainly in the statement of facts, and there's about five or six or eight people who work for the director of the workers' compensation, and they didn't account for those. But that must first assume that the affidavit is proper evidence, and I submit, Your Honor, that it's not. The only way that you can prove, set up a motion, and support it, and that's by testimony. Affidavits are merely a vehicle to get the issue before the court.
Counsel, is the
statutes define default?
Excuse me?
Is there a statutory definition?
None that I'm aware of. None that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
So the Chief Justice and the opposing counsel and you have all addressed the question of nil dicit default judgment. There's been no answers being filed. And there's been no participation in the case. There's been no preparation made for trial. But once an answer has been filed, that controverts the plaintiff's pleading, you have a different animal. I'm really confused here, and I think the court's sincerely groping to try to determine whether what the purpose in this provision was. Was it to avoid people sneaking up on the state with a default judgment, running in and taking a default when no answer's been filed, no preparation's been made, or is it to apply to even the cases where all preparation has been made, and where I think, as you pointed out, the state has requested this particular setting, and it's a jury trial situation, and they're replete with notice that there's going to be a trial that day. That's not a true default.
Your Honor, I can give you my...
Or does the term default is used in the statute, this notice requirement, incorporate judgments? Nil dicit?
I think not, Your Honor. I can give you my opinion about the reason for the statute. The Attorney General represents many agencies. Some of them are small agencies, the Antiquities Commission, and whatever. And those people get sued. Sometimes they don't know what to do with the citation when they've been sued. They send it to the mayor or they send it somewhere else, and the answer date passes by. The Attorney General doesn't file an answer and default's taken. I suggest that that's the purpose of the statute in those cases where they have not had an opportunity, their own clients, they're charged with by law to represent, have not informed them that they've been sued, and they haven't had an opportunity to make an appearance.
Why isn't it just as likely that the purpose is to protect the people of the state of Texas from paying a judgment that is the result from a screw-up by the Attorney General's office?
Well, Your Honor, I guess that that could be the purpose of it. I think it would... work habit on the trial dockets across this state if that's permitted. I mean, there's got to be some finality to judgments, and there's got to be some rule of order for the disposition of cases.
I guess if this statute were applied, as the Attorney General argues, that they could refuse to show up on successive occasions, and you'd never be able to get a default unless you gave them notice 10 days ahead of time, that if they didn't show up next time, that you're going to take a default.
I think that's true, Your Honor. Then I think what you would see is that every time a case is set for trial with AG, there would be a notice in there, if you don't show up on this day, we're going to take a default judgment, and we're right back to square one. I know that's what I would do. I would put it in my pleadings. The answer date is first Monday after 21 days when you get service, and if you don't show up, I'm going to take a default judgment against you.
Situation like that, is it foreseeable that in some complex litigation in which the state was a party defendant involved great expense of bringing out of state, perhaps even out of country, witnesses and producing very expensive evidence, the state could multiply your expenses astronomically and geometrically simply by not showing up and then coming in 9 or 10 days later.
And the trial judge would have, if that interpretation of statute is made by this court, the trial judge would lose control over the docket, certainly over the Attorney General's part of it. If the statute says what they've argued that it says and means that, then the trial judge just can't control the Attorney General.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Counsel, what are the safeguards in a situation like that? What is to prevent the Attorney General from abusing that notice provision?
I believe that there are adequate safeguards in the form of sanctions to the Attorney General's office?
What kind of sanctions? When, if we read the statute as you suggest, they clearly, as a matter of right, are entitled to 10 days' notice if they don't show up for a jury trial setting, and you've got witnesses from Hong Kong and Paris and Vienna and Moscow and all over the globe, and maybe even Argentina and Buenos Aires or somewhere. And you've got very expensive witnesses. You've got a lot of expenses. And so you hold them there for 10 days waiting for the state to show up. You pay their hotel bills. And you've got a jury sitting there hanging in limbo. It increases. It's not a real efficient way to administer justice. How can the court impose sanctions when they clearly have a statutory right not to show up for 10 days?
Well, the statute merely provides that a default judgment cannot be entered. I don't think that in any way impairs the other rights that the trial court has of imposing sanctions upon a motion of a party or Rule 13 sanctions, where in this case the Attorney General's office had set it for trial, had signed the document setting it for trial. So perhaps Rule 13 sanctions would be appropriate to reimburse the plaintiff for their expenses if they did have to bring any witnesses from out of state. In this case, that situation didn't occur. It was a workers' compensation case, and the only witness presented by the plaintiff was, of course, his client. But the trial court would have the power to impose monetary sanctions or contempt of court. There are other remedies besides the default.
One follow-up question. Where is default defined? Now, I know you addressed that what default incorporates. It comes under the umbrella of default before, but what authority do you have for saying an illicit is a default?
Again, I don't think it's specifically defined by any statute. I think this court in Stoner versus Thompson explains to some extent what it is, and that default judgment means these various types of default judgment, no answer or failure to appear at trial, that it is a default judgment situation. I think the other thing that tells us that what the legislature meant when they said default judgment is comparing 39001 to Section 30.004 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. 30.004 specifically applies to default judgments for failure to file an answer. That statute says that if any petition is filed against the state, a copy of the petition must be mailed to the Attorney General's office, and if it's not, that any default judgment shall be set aside without cause. So we've got that one specific statute, 30.004, that we know applies to only default judgments for failure to answer. So that, I think, tells us that 39.001 has to have meaning. We have to presume the legislature intended it to have meaning. So it's got to have meaning apart from 30.004. So what they meant when they used the term default judgment was all types of default judgments.
Do you have any legislative history on that issue?
I've researched the legislative history for 1983 when it was passed. 1985 there was an amendment. In 1987 it was put into the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And there's nothing in the legislative history to tell us that the legislature specifically discussed or considered that issue. The only thing I've found that addresses that issue is a newspaper article from the Wichita Falls Record News on April 3rd, 1983.
Very authoritative.
I think so. That interviewed Senator Ray Farabee. Senator Farabee was the sponsor of the bill and introduced it in 1983. And he was interviewed and told the newspaper that the inspiration for the bill was a 1982 case where a default judgment had been taken against Texas A&M in a workers' comp case because the AG failed to appear at trial.
After answering,
and failed to appear at trial in Brazos County, and a default judgment was taken. So that specific incident in 1982 was what prompted Senator Farabee to introduce the legislation. So we know certainly at least that the senator who introduced it, that was his intent.
Do you think that that a trial judge proceeding the judgment in the face of the statute would constitute error on the face of the record so it could be set aside by a writ of error?
I believe it could. That the state would have several remedies. It would have a remedy of a motion for
that, of course, they can wait 6 months. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument from this morning's submission docket, and the foregoing clauses are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Yeah, I am.